Last week on Truth and Justice, I broke down for you the entirety of the state's case against Jason Baldwin. As you heard, they really didn't have any case. The primary focus that resonated with the jurors, according to the charts they made during their deliberations, was simply the fact that Jason Baldwin was Damien Eccles' best friend. Although the state did land three punches. One being the testimony of Michael Carson, who had served time with Jason in the detention center, the second being the discovery of the so-called lake knife, and lastly, there was the red fiber that was tied back to Jason Baldwin's home. As you heard, what the jury did not have the advantage of hearing was the fact that more advanced testing of the fibers concluded that they were in fact not a match to anything in Jason Baldwin's house. The lake knife was never tied to the crime in any way, and later affidavits revealed that most likely the West Memphis police knew that the lake knife had been thrown in the lake over a year before the murders had occurred. And lastly, the fact that Michael Carson, at this point, does not stand behind his testimony that he gave in 1994. And that is the entire story, according to the court records, of Jason Baldwin's arrest, trial, and conviction. But as I said last week, there is much more to this story, and that story can only be told by Jason Baldwin himself. Jason, so in this week's episode, we broke down basically the three elements of the state's case against you, short of what the thing that I think resonated the most with the jurors, which was the fact that you were Damien's best friend. But the three items that the jurors listed in their con category for you in the jury charts were the testimony of Michael Carson and the red fiber evidence, and lastly, the lake knife. So I think I'd like to start today, if it's all right with you, is we'll kind of go through each of those points and give you a chance to rebut or explain anything surrounding them. So if that works for you, let's start with Michael Carson's testimony. What was your relationship with Michael Carson in jail? Were you actually in jail with him?
I was in jail for over 289 days. A lot of that was spent, you know, just locked in my cell with no contact with anyone. But sometimes there was school and things like that, and sometimes after I was there for a long time, they let me out with other people. And there are people that were there that I can remember that were there pretty much the whole time I was there. You know, and I can name these people. You know, I know what they look like and you know, and things like that and stuff like that. But then there's other people that kind of came in real fast, you know, was gone overnight or whatever. The first 48 hours there, you're not even allowed out of your cell, anybody. So that's anybody, which me, they been in that for a long time, even several months. But even then, so a lot of people came and went that I didn't really make note of. I didn't make note of Michael Carson. In fact, I couldn't even tell you what he looked like. I remember at the trial, actually, the first time I made note of him was he was walking in the courtroom. Paul pulled me to the side and said, "Hey, here's a kid coming in. He's going to testify that you told him that you committed the crime while you were in jail. Make sure, like the judge says, you show no emotion, no outburst, because it's important that you're here during your own trial." All right. So this is the first time Paul said anything to me about this guy, right? And about what he's going to do to me right then. And then I can't even say anything about it because as I just said, what Paul reminded me, Judge Burnett had a rule with us, you know, hey, you're to sit there and be quiet and not say anything no matter what you hear. The only time you can say anything is from the stand. And so the whole time I'm waiting to take the stand. I'm waiting for my family to take the stand and everything. And I'm doing exactly as I'm told, trusting the people who is the protectors of justice, who are supposed to be trying to find the truth, you know, to do so. And then comes this kid who tells us a lie, just flat out lied on me. And at the time I knew nothing about him, nothing about why he did what he did right there on the stand, why he lied, or nothing. But years later, you know, pieces of the puzzle would come, and people would tell me, like my new attorneys would tell me things, and that my private investigators would find out about him and things like that. like, I was just the first person he would do this to. He would go on to do this many times over. You know, and maybe some of the people later on were actually guilty of whatever he was saying they did, but some of them had to be innocent like I was, you know. But he was given carte blanche and basically a get out of jail free card to do any type of illegal activity. And all he had to do was turn people into the state, whoever was the most famous case going on. And at that time in that jail, it was my case. And I was listening to your podcast and he said it was his father that urged him to contact the police. But we learned, you know, through my private investigators and stuff, that his father, you know, had also learned to make deals with the state attorney, with the prosecutors and stuff to get out of criminal charges, to, you know, just give somebody up, whether they're innocent or guilty. And so after I was convicted and after I was at Barner for a long time, I got a letter from this counselor, Danny Williams, who gave me another piece of the story. He told me what, you know, you were talking about in the podcast, the last podcast, that, you know, he was trying to use a scare tactic against his client to scare him straight, because this counselor didn't know I was innocent. He only knew what the whole public knew, and the whole public was turned against me by the media. And so there was no presumption of innocence. And so he told this macabre, crazy story to this kid. And then this kid, Michael Carson, uses that as a get, you know, as leverage, as ransom to buy his way out of his crimes. And that Michael Carson, that's how his lies impacted my life. It took my life away. It took Damien's life away. Jesse, you know, it is, at this point, his trial was already over with and his life was taken away already, but he had his liar and his trial, you know, who was a different scenario. I don't think she necessarily looked for an opportunity to get her crimes off the book, as more of the fact she was kind of forced and leveraged into it, like, hey, we're going to take your son away if you don't produce something, even if it's fiction. So they create the desperation in these people who are on the fringes of society, who are illegals, for one lack of a better word, you know, someone who's committed a crime. And in Vicki Hutchinson's case, I think that was someone who our system just needed to help instead of harm. This woman, a young mother who just got out of a divorce and was trying, you know, do her best. And I don't know if she was guilty of the check issue or if it was just an honest mistake, but obviously it was obvious her and her family needed help. And instead, the state harmed her and took advantage of her and took advantage of us all. It's all related to Michael Carson and the effect that people will lie in court on an innocent, against an innocent person for their crimes to go away, in effect. And the prosecution gives them this power. And for us, we're not even allowed to question it or impeach them on it. I remember the judge ruling that we couldn't even question him about what he was even in the jail for. It was like he just like magically appeared there and was visiting or something, like just walking through. It wasn't even in there on a crime. It was just very not even, not fair. And I know me personally, I kept thinking every day I was going to get to testify. Every day I was going to see my mom and my brothers testify. I was going to see my great-granduncle Hubert testify. You know, and so they couldn't be in the courtroom or anything. And Paul kept saying, you know, not today, maybe tomorrow, you know, and just kept putting me off until the whole trial was over with. And then he was like, well, maybe you'll get to testify, you know, on your appeal. And I wouldn't get to testify until years later in my Rule 37 hearing, you know, and with the new attorneys. And all I had to do was tell him once, hey, I need to testify, and he says, I'll make it happen. And that's what Paul should have done. He should have said, I'll make it happen, instead of just putting me off every day and until the trial was over with, and then my chance to let the jurors and everyone know the truth was God, you know. And years later, and you know, here recently, you know, just reading other cases that he's worked on and things like that, and transcripts of trials and things, and I found testimony where he's told jurors and stuff during voir dire to where it was basically his decision to put witnesses on the stand, to put his client on the stand, and not his client's decision to do that because he was the attorney, he knew better. And that's wrong. That's against the law. It's not right. And that's not even what he led me to believe. He misled me. And so when the system is that stacked against you, innocent can't win. I couldn't win. Damien couldn't win. Jesse couldn't win. Our voices couldn't be heard. Our family's voices couldn't be heard. Well, at least, well, in Jesse's case, at least his family got to testify. But then, like, I heard in your podcast, I'm talking about the yellow ribbon, you know, for Jesse and the family community. What was supposed to be something beautiful, they made it into something ugly or tried to. And so that goes into the whole statement, and they say, you know, don't say anything to the police because anything you say can and will be used against you. But when you're innocent, you're thinking, well, you can't use anything against me because I'm innocent. So I'm going to help you. I'm going to tell you everything I know about my innocence to help you. But that statement, anything can and will be used against you, is true because at that point, the state's not looking to exonerate you. They're looking to convict you. And so they're looking to make anything a weapon against you. And so it's a terrible situation to be in, and it's unfair, and the deck is stacked against you from the start.
Were there any elements to Carson's story that added up? Like, for example, during your time in the detention center, did you know a guy named Bettle? Did you know another guy named Jason? Did you play spades on a regular basis? Any of those things?
Oh, well, definitely. There are things that add up, like Daniel Bettle is the guy that was in there. Jason Duncan was the guy that was in there. I mean, jail was kind of the opposite of prison. And when I went on later, went to prison, they didn't have cards, but they had dominoes. But in jail, they didn't have dominoes, but they had cards. You know, and so spades was a game that the guys played and stuff. During my Rule 37 hearing, Jason Duncan came and testified about that and about Michael Carson and how Michael Carson was lying. That he basically, Jason Duncan was in there the whole time I was in there, and he knows that I professed my innocence from day one and knows what my experience was like from day one. And for Michael Carson to get there and give that testimony, he knew it was a lie. And so he testified to that effect. My private detective, Mr. Quinn, got affidavits, sworn affidavits from the other guys that were in there, like Daniel Biddle. And he testified, you know, about his time in there with me and how I professed my innocence to him and how Michael Carson was lying against me. How Miss Curitan, the lady who ran the jail, the ran the whole jail, not just the individual jailers, but the whole juvenile side. She swore on an affidavit that, in her opinion, Michael Carson was lying just by knowing him and the various times he had come into the jail, and then knowing me through the whole time I was there in jail, because she would call me out to her office, you know, there in the jail, like out of my cage or cell or whatever, out of the barracks, the juvenile barracks, into her office. And like one time she even had my probation officer there, Steve Jones. And right there, you know, he asked me, he goes, point blank, he goes, Jason, did you do it? And I told him no. And she was like, that's what I believe all along. I never believe you do it. You did it just by watching you in here. And I watch these guys come and go all the time. I can tell you, this is her words to Steve Jones. She's like, I can tell you who the guilty ones are after a while. And so she wanted to testify for me at my trial, but it seemed like everybody who wanted to testify for the truth, no matter if they worked, no matter who they were, whether they were my family or somebody that just, they were, you know, working for the sheriff's department way in Craighead County, if they, you know, came to the truth, you know, about my situation, you know, her truth was that she knew Michael Carson and believed he was lying against me. And so the sheriff disappeared her during my trial. Like, I don't know how that happened. Like, if he just like came over and was like, hey, come with me, and kept her out of town for the whole trial or what, you know, but she ran that jail fairly and strong. She was a strong woman, and it just scares me the length that the state went to bar the truth from getting out in our case at every step. And how even my public defender, Paul Ford, was even, you know, complicit in it, and the fact that he didn't call any of my witnesses. And I don't know if he didn't learn of Michael Carson testifying like right then, right before me, but however long it was, he should have told me before, like he was walking through the door. Like, even if it was that morning, like, he should have said, hey, here's what's going on. You know, what do you know about this guy? You know, what's going on? You know, and just ask me and let me know, you know, something.
Do you think that his whole strategy at trial was basically to try to let you fade into the background? Because it seemed like he didn't really put up a defense. I think his defense was simply that the state didn't have a case against you. Does that seem accurate to you?
Yes, that definitely seems accurate. His case is, they didn't meet the burden of proof. So that was it, you know, but he has to listen to me, you know, he works for me. And I told him, you know, hey, I agree that they haven't met their burden of proof, but I also want to testify. And so he would just always ask me, you know, did they prove their case? And I'd be like, no, and then that would be it, you know, and he wouldn't let me say, you know, I want to still testify, you know, even though he knew that.
So one of the things that may have cleared things up for the jury, had you been allowed to testify, is the so-called lake knife that was presented at trial, that, you know, the divers found behind your dock or your pier at your house. And had you been allowed to testify, what would the jurors have heard about the history of the so-called lake knife?
Well, they would have heard that it was definitely mine, and they would have heard, you know, how it got in the lake and how the summer before, when Damien, after he had run away with Deanna and got locked away and everything, I was out on the dock fishing, you know, with my mom, my brother Terry, and I'm not sure who all else was there. There were several, like, Terry's friends and stuff there, and maybe Mike and Chris, you know. These kids, they just come and go because we all live like right on the same street, you know, they just run in and out of the yards at whatever particular time. But I remember Terry was playing in the tackle box. This is my youngest brother. He's 7 years younger than me. And he cut himself with the knife, and my mom got mad. And I was like, I know she probably said something to him a million times about messing around with, you know, knives and stuff like that. And sure enough, there he is right there and cuts himself. So she grabs it and throws it in the lake, right? And then I get mad. I'm like, oh my God, you know, why you throw it in the lake? Why can't you just talk to him? So I grab my survival knife by the sheet and I go, what if I just throw this in the lake? You know, what? But when I mind throwing it, I was holding it by the sheet and it just went flying out of the sheath. Like, I'm still holding the sheath, like miming I'm throwing it, but it went flying out of the sheath, the knife did, into the lake. And I was like, you know, watching it, and it's like going in slow motion with my jaw dropped, like, oh no. I just threw my knife away. And yeah, and then she was like, oh, well, that's even better.
So she had thrown Terry's knife in. And then you were being basically a smart ass kid and were pretending to throw yours in to make a point and then did.
Well, I was just trying to belabor the ill logic, how illogical a phone. I guess it was logical from her point of view. And I told you not to play with it. You did. You cut yourself. I'm throwing it away. All right. Right here, right now. That's logical from her point of view. Me, I was like, oh my God, you can't just throw things away. And so what if I just throw this away right now? Or somebody over explaining things now, you know, this all happened in a split second. But yeah, and then it just flew, you know, and I was like, oh my God, you know, but I told Paul this, it had been out there. I was like, hey, there's got to be some type of test you can do to determine how long this knife has been in the lake, right? Besides comparing it to the wounds, which we found out they did a one-to-one comparison. I think it was Peretti or Kermit Channel did. It's been a long time since I looked at this report, and I don't have any of them anymore. I got to get all that back. Mr. Phillips' point. But one of those medical examiners did a one-to-one comparison, and it didn't match. And so Fogelman knew that. The wounds that he was pointing to and alluding to during the closing arguments, he knew that his own medical examiner did a test and that they didn't match. And he knew that he did not turn over those results to Paul Ford or me or any of the attorneys during or before the trial or whenever he got them. You know, he knew all of that. And, but, you know, even besides that, if Paul would have let me testify, I'd have told the jury all this stuff. And then, like I told Paul, like, hey, there's got to be some type of way to tell how long it's been in the lake. Like, because snails and mussels, like, there's wildlife that live in the lake. And they have life cycles from freshwater shrimp, and they leave traces of themselves on things, you know. So I'm like, do that, you know, and also do forensic testing, you know, and stuff. Which we didn't know that there had already been a one-on-one comparison by the state medical examiner, and it was ruled not to match. We should have been already told that. Anyway, kind of I went around in circles there because some things I found out later that were happening at that time that didn't make sense to me then. I just knew, the only thing I knew then, that I did not commit the murders. I knew that. I knew that that knife was not the murder weapon. I knew it had been in the lake the summer before. And I knew those. And Paul said, hey, the whole reason we're doing this whole HBO documentary thing is to get money for experts, right? And to me, that means forensic testing and things like that. So I'm like, hey, here's something we can do with that. We can determine how long the knife's been in the water. We can also determine, you know, compare it to the wounds and stuff like that and to rule it out. And all that, but he never did any of that. So
now later, I think it was in 2004, 2008, Dominie Teer and, I don't know, is he a friend of yours? Garrett Schwarting had come forward and said that they knew the knife was in the lake. And in fact, that they had told police that the knife was in the lake. Were either of them around, or do you know how they knew that the knife had been in the lake prior to the murders?
You know, I don't know how they knew. I may have told them. I mean, my brothers may have told them. It's been a whole year, you know, it's been a long term, you know. And so I'm sure somebody knew. I mean, my brothers and everybody knew then and everything. So, but beside the point, my mom told Fogelman before he ever went out and searched for the knife that it was there and where it was at, how it got there, right? But then he said later on that he got a hunch that it was in the lake and exactly where it was at and all this stuff, right, that he got a hunch. That's impossible. The reason he said it was a hunch instead of attributing it to my mom, because he would have to then call my mom up there, and he didn't want my mom on the stand to testify. None of them wanted my mom. None of them wanted me to testify. They didn't want the truth to get out. That's why he attributed it to this hocus-pocus hunch stuff, you know, and that's why they resorted to the old satanic change the case number to 555 to 666 to make you, you know, cloud your reason and not even see the case anymore, you know, because they've taken all the facts away and replaced them with stuff to make you hate somebody.
And speaking of clouding facts, well, the other element of the state's case was the fiber evidence. And they had experts testify at your trial that said that your mother's bathrobe couldn't be excluded from the red fibers found at the crime scene. I'm sure there's not a whole lot to be said about that, because we found out in later testing that was absolutely not true.
And the lady who testified to that, whose testimony they relied on, was Lisa Sacabisha, let's say her name. But yeah, and she even misapplied her own science to that. But even applying her science, she had like all these handful of different fibers that they went into each of our houses, right? And they were able to find something similar to each of us. But they could go with that handful they had, they can go to every single house in America, and they might not find one to match the red one in your house or the green one, but it might be the purple one, right? And in Michael's house, it might be the fluorescent green one or whatever, you know. They're going to find one in everybody's house from the pool they were looking for to match their standards of similar, right? But yeah, like you said, using better technology later, it wasn't even similar. So that was a non-fact to rely on.
So another thing that the jury never got to hear during your trial was where you were on the night of the murder, since you didn't get called to testify. So let's ask that question again. Had you been allowed to testify, what would the jury have heard regarding your alibi?
Well, I remember them asking me what I did that day and everything, and, you know, from the time I got up to the time I went to bed.
Was that what the police were asking you?
Correct. And everybody, you know, my attorneys, my own attorneys, Paul Thor, Robin Wadley, you know, and then even though no one asked me on the stand during my trial, people had asked me up to that point, you know. And so I don't know when the kids were murdered or whatever. So I'm just telling them where I was at all day, you know, where I was at the whole day, like they asked, you know, and it started out, you know, getting up, getting my brothers up and getting ready for school. This was a Wednesday, May the 5th, 1993. We lived on the lake, you know, and my brothers are pretty easy most of the time. You know, I just wake them up. I usually get up first and get ready and then get them up and get them started getting ready. And then I'll go sit out on the dock, out on the lake, you know, and, watch the sunrise. You know, and if we have any leftover bread, you know, feed the ducks or whatever, you know, but that's something I did every day, you know, unless it was raining or cold or whatever. So, but that day was no different. And I went to school, and when I got home from school, Damien and Dominique were outside my yard waiting, and I can't remember now if Ken shows up or if he was already there, right?
You're talking about Ken Watkins?
Correct.
Okay.
At some point, we're in my room, right? And Damien and Dominique are making out, and me and Ken are playing Nintendo, and Dennis, my mom's boyfriend, opens the door and says, "Hey, you got a phone call from your uncle," right? My Uncle Hubert. And so I already know what it's about. I got to mow his yard, right? And so I get the phone. He's like, "Hey, you come cut my grass?" I'm like, "Yes, sir, I'll be there. You know, I'm on my way, you know." And so hang up, and I tell Damien, Dominique, and Ken, "Hey, I'm going to go mow my uncle's grass. Y'all can come with me. Y'all can stay here. Y'all can go somewhere else, whatever. I got to go, you know, mow Uncle Hubert's grass." I didn't tell you this last time when you came down to Austin, but I usually cut his grass on the weekends unless something happens, right? And the previous weekend, Saturday it had rained, and Sunday I had an art show in Marion at high school. We had a big art exhibit and art show and everything, so I had to be there for that and everything, so I couldn't mow his grass then. But I mowed his grass every week, so I couldn't like skip a week, but I could like maybe go maybe a week and a half or whatever. So anyway, so I can't. I got to mow his grass today on Wednesday because it's sunny or whatever. And so, you know, they're all like, hey, we'll go with you, you know, to your uncle's house, mow the grass. I'm like, cool. And so we walked from my house to my Uncle Hubert's house. And my Uncle Hubert lives in West Memphis. And I don't know his address, but he lives right underneath the water tower on the same block as the Boys Club. In West Memphis, anybody that knows the geography of West Memphis, that's where he lives. And the main road is like behind his house. But anyway, so we walk over to my uncle's house and they all stay out on the porch. I go in and talk to my uncle and then go out the back door and go get, you know, the lawnmower and start mowing the yard and everything. And then Ken, somehow or another, some point or another, comes around and sits on the back porch. And when I get through mowing the backyard, I notice Damon and Dominique aren't there anymore. And I'm like, hey, you know, I ask Kent, you know, where'd Damon and Dominique go? And he's like, oh, they had to leave and tell and let Damien's mom know that they weren't at your house anymore, at my house. And to go, you know, so Damon's mom could go pick them up. So wherever they went, which I found out later, they went around the corner to the laundromat and called, used the payphone, but I didn't know that then, right? So he just told me they left to go call Damon's mom to let them know to pick them up. So I finished mowing the grass, and my uncle pays me $10, right? And sometimes he can't pay, and sometimes he can. It just depends on if he got money or not, the time he had money, which was good. I mean, I don't complain if he can't. Usually gives me, if he can't pay, he'll give me a fishing lure. Like these really old timey, like handcrafted made out of wood fishing lures. So I didn't even use them. I just kept them. So but anyway, I needed money. And so he gave me money this time, $10. And so I wanted to go to skating rink that coming up weekend. And so I know I need at least $5 because it's like $4.50 or $4.75 to get in. The door, I need at least $5 of that. And my friend Adam has this tape that I've been wanting to buy from him. He told me he'll give it to me for $5, but, you know, I might be able to talk him down for him, which I would end up doing. And so Ken and I walked back from my uncle's house to Lakeshore, at the Lakeshore, and on the way we stopped at Walmart. And in front of Walmart, they had these Coke machines to where you can get a Coke for 20 cents, a Sam's Choice soda for 20 cents. And so I'm like, okay, I can take $1 of this 10, right? Ken and I can get a soda pop, and we can also play the video game before we finish going home, right? And I'll still have $9, which would be good for skating rink and for buying tape from Adam. So Ken, I hold the video game down. Ken goes in and gets changed, comes back, and we start playing, drinking soda pop. And I notice right next to us waiting, somebody come up, you know. I don't know if you've ever, of course you have, Bob. You played at the arcade, right? Arcade video game.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and so when you're waiting, somebody will stand up to the side. I noticed this kid that was Asian. Right. And this time I'm in the 10th grade and I've been living in Marion since the last day of school for the 5th grade, you know, started going to school in Marion at the first day of school at the 6th grade. So I left Memphis, Tennessee at the end of 5th grade. And in Memphis, I lived in Shelby County. And, I had this friend, one of my best friends, name was Vincent. His mother was from Vietnam and his dad, you know, was a white guy. and he was from the Navy and everything. And so I always missed him. I missed him more, you know, earlier, you know, when we first moved. But when I saw this kid there, it reminded me of Vincent, right? Instantly. Of course, I didn't say, "Hey, man, you remind me of Vincent." I didn't say anything to him, you know, or nothing like that. But it reminded me of him, you know, so I remembered that. Because in Marion, there wasn't any Asian kids that I knew of, you know, that I knew. You know, there may have been in other classes, you know, that I didn't really have close contact with. But anyway, that kid reminded me of Vincent. And so Ken and I, we finished playing and walk back to Lakeshore. And Ken was like, "Hey, I'm going to head on home." And we come to his house. His house is on the street right next to my street. Right? I don't know the names of them. They're just right next to each other. And so he goes home and then I go home and then I stop at the house and then get a drink of water or whatever and then go on to Adam's house. And at Adam's house, it's his mom, his dad, and I don't know their names, and his sister. His sister was like, to me at that time was like, I don't know. Teenage years were weird, especially girls. Like, she was like a goddess to me, you know, like, she was this emitted bright light, and I just couldn't be in her presence, like, without faltering over my words and things, you know, like, I can't talk all of a sudden, you know. And so she was older, and her boyfriend was there and stuff. And so anyway, Adam and I went to his room, you know, and I was like, "Hey, you still got the Iron Maiden tape on him, you know, Iron Maiden Power Save on the body?" He's like, "Yeah, $5. I'm like, "Hey, how about $4? And he's like, and I was, of course, had $4 right then. I took out my pocket. I'm like, he's like, "All right, you know," and so cool. And so I went back home. My brothers, you know, in and out of the house, you know, go to their room. You know, they share a room and stuff. And we had a tuna casserole that night that my mom had made. And before she went to work, before school was out, because she go to work, I don't know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And before school is out, she's at work, you know, when I get out of school and stuff, and gets home from work sometime after I'm asleep. And so I sit down and eat and watch The Wonder Years and talk to Jennifer, Holly, this other girl, Holly, not my wife now, this other girl, you know, and stuff on the phone. And when I go to bed, I have this double cassette stereo that I got for Christmas. My mom got it for Christmas. Last Christmas. How's that, right? And so I put my new tape in, Iron Maiden Power Slave in, side A on that side. And you could put on the other one, put any other tape in and just put it on pause and play. And so when that tape kicks off, the first one kicks off, the other one to kick on. So I go to sleep jamming out. But my mom would always come in while I'm asleep sometime and just turn the whole stereo off, you know. And so when I get up in the morning, you know, and turn the stereo on, I'd have to always make sure turn it down, you know, because if I turn it on, you know, early in the morning, it'd be jamming out because it'd be still on wherever it was when she came in and turned it off when she got in from work. And then the next day, you know, I was in Coach Baca's class when they came in and they was like, "Turn on the TV." And they, you know, we had the news, they turned the news on, and that's when they reported that they found 3 missing 8-year-old boys in West Memphis, you know, found their bodies and stuff. So that's how I found out.
And you were in school when you found out.
Right. Yeah.
So a month later, you were arrested. You spent almost a full year in jail waiting trial. Then the conviction came, and we know the story, the post-conviction relief that went on, and then you guys all three accepting the Alford plea and going home. Can you talk a little bit as we're getting ready to wind down and close this up, but what has your life been like, and what have you been up to since you were released from prison in 2011?
Oh, it's, you know, it's been in a lot of ways, it's been many prayers answered, you know, because, you know, my mom and my family no longer has to worry about what's happening to me in prison, you know, because for a long time, it was bad, you know, I had bones broken, people were trying to kill me and stuff, you know. And so for my mom, she doesn't care about the Alfred place. She's just glad that I'm free and she got in her, you know, her baby back, you know, because I'm always going to be her baby to her, you know.
Yeah.
That's my mom's way, you know. For me, it's been tough because I hate the injustice of the Alfred place so much, you know, for so many different reasons. One of the reasons Holly and I've got to be good friends and close with Pam Hicks, you know, the mother of Steve Branch, who was killed, you know. And so through all this time, she's been grief-stricken and been hurt and wounded and taken on the emotional roller coaster of not knowing who murdered her son, and then the state not continuing the pursuit of truth and justice in this. So that's been hard. And at the same time, you know, growing up in prison, I met other innocent people, like, because they would hear it after they figured out I was innocent in many years, you know. Other innocent people would come up to me and say, hey, man, your case, when you guys get to go home, it's going to open everybody's eyes and open the door for the other innocent people in Arkansas to show that, you know, innocent people do go to prison. And so these post-conviction rules and cases, it'll give them strength and give the politicians and DAs or whatever strength to use them to free innocents instead of, you know, just not allowing innocent people to even put forth their case as a finality or whatever, you know. And so the Alfred plea set precedent where the state's able to continue this fallacy, this lie, and say that they don't convict innocent people. And so they're able to continue that problem and not put forth any effort. Like, a lot of states now have innocence integrity units and things like that, to where the state actively goes and tries to find innocent people who have been, you know, slipped through the cracks and try to bring them out and give them some hope. But that's the opposite happened in Arkansas. And there's so many injustices because of that, you know. And so since I've been out, one of my good friends, John Harden, who was really good friends with Damien's wife, Lori, my now wife, Holly, who was just my friend during my incarceration, but they had started a group called Arkansas Take Action while we were inside to combat the lie that the Arkansas officials were telling everybody, just that said, you know, the only people that believed that we were innocent or cared about the case were foreigners, people from New York or Hollywood, not from Arkansas. So John and Holly, they're all from Arkansas. They're like, and Mara Leverett and stuff. People are like, we're here from Arkansas. We know that these guys are innocent and we want you to look at this case. So that's what they did with Arkansas Take Action. And so when we were released, John and I were talking. He's like, hey, you know, even though you guys are out now, I still want to help other innocent people. You know, I feel like this is my life's mission. And I'm like, hey, I promised the guys I left behind I wouldn't forget them, you know. And so let's do something. And so we put together, Proclaim Justice, and we're mirroring it off Centurion Ministries, which is the very first innocence organization. And Jim McCleskey, who started it, has mentored John throughout the years, you know, several years, and on organizational structure and how to put it together and everything, and really worked close with us on, you know, just how to bring the organization itself to life, you know. And so, you know, so that's what we do. We investigate poor people, innocent people who, you know, don't have hope, who don't have a chance, you know, don't have anybody fighting for them. So we're getting in there and trying to get those guys home. And so when we first were released, I remember, somebody asked Damien, they were like, hey, do you know of any other innocent people on death row? You know, and, he was like, yeah, you know, and, so he told him our guy, Tim, I won't tell him his name. And so that was one of, John was like, hey, I would really like to work on his case. It was one of our first cases. And so we actually took up his case, and now just before Christmas, he was on death row, and now he's free. Got to spend his first Christmas free, you know, and not on death row.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And so even though we didn't get him exonerated and we feel we should have, and we are not giving up on that, to have his life saved, I think, is a big thing. I know, he went through something similar with working on, Ed, is that his name?
Ed Eight. Cakes? Yeah.
Yeah, Ed Eight. You know, y'all had to go through the parole route with him, right? And so we had to do something similar with him. You know, he had to get out on parole, but he's not going to be executed. He's not on death row anymore. And so, we got another innocent guy, Daniel Villegas. He's been out free for several years on appeal bond in El Paso. And, he gave a false confession when he was like 15 to a crime he didn't commit, and, spent 18 years as a slave in Texas Department of Corrections, you know, doing, I know what kind of work he was doing. I grew up in the slave field of Arkansas. He grew up in the slave field of Texas, and he probably had it worse because it's even more south, you know, so it's probably even hotter for him and more difficult. So anyway, he goes back up for trial finally next month. So we've been telling the, state, hey, you know, they've been threatening to try him, you know, for several years. We're like, all right, do it or not, you know, don't continue to just hold it over his head, you know, but for his part, Daniel, he has lived his life fully, you know, worked for a construction company, had a baby, got another baby. I mean, so, which worries me, you know, that, you know, the state brings some kind of person who lies on him, you know, again or something. I don't know. But I don't think the state will, now that they know he has people in his corner, that, you know, will check the veracity of everything, that they won't bring any jailhouse liars and things like that. And his false confessions been thrown out, so they can't use that against him. So I feel confident in his case. I don't see why the state's wasting their money and retrying him, but that's what they want to do.
At least it'll finally give him a chance to get it off of his record if he's able to obtain an acquittal.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I know how he feels. You know, he's looking forward to that, you know, as strange as that sounds, because trials are strange. Like when somebody will be up there, like Michael Carson, telling lies and you're listening to it and you want to say, hey, guys, that dude's lying. But you know, right, the judge has told you can't say anything, so you can't even make a facial expression like, come on, y'all believe in that or whatever, you know, like anybody, right, would do if you know somebody's lying in your presence, you know, you're not allowed to do that. And so there I was doing everything I was told to do, and even that was used against me. Like they say, everything can and will be used against me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, so your organization with your partner, John Harden, is called Proclaim Justice, and you guys are based in Austin, Texas. Is there a way where our listeners, if they want to support your guys' organization, where they could go to donate to your cause?
Oh, yes, definitely. We have a website, proclaimjustice.org, and on that they have a page where you can click and donate, and then there's also a section about us, our creed, what we're about, our board of directors, cases that we're publicly working on, and things like that, and other ways that you can volunteer your services. Like, if you don't have like money to donate, but say you're an investigator or you're a paralegal or you're an actual, you know, attorney wanting to take on a case pro bono, or at least at cost, that's a way for you to contact us through there. So that would be awesome. And we've been going for a while now, but I still feel like always that we're just now, you know, getting on our feet or getting our feet under us or whatever, like we're just kind of growing or whatever. I guess maybe I'll always feel like that about it, you know. But I went to the 25th anniversary gala of the Innocence Project that Barry Sheck and those guys and Peter Newfield and Jason Plum and Jim Dwyer started, and to hear them tell their stories of how they started out and, you know, the beginnings, and then to see the impact they've had over 25 years, you know, is humbling, but I'm like, okay, so it's all right. You start out struggling, you know, and just barely making things work and happen. You're gonna, as long as you just keep doing that, putting forth 100% of your effort every day, you're gonna make something great happen, and it's gonna multiply out to many people and do good things. So that's what I just keep doing every day.
Hopefully that interview with Jason answered a lot of the questions that many of you may have had. You got to hear what the jury would have heard had Jason testified at his own trial. And as we continue to draw closer on our mid-season break for season 5, we're going to continue our theme of giving you the behind-the-scenes first-hand information about what happened with each of the defendants. And on deck, we have Jesse Ms. Kelly's attorney, Mr. Dan Stidham, next week on Truth and Justice. Truth and Justice is a production of NBI Studios. Michael Bussing is your executive producer, and Shane Yoder is our sound engineer. All music for the show was created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. And Shane Yoder of PutThemInASong.com designed and created our Season 5 logo. A special thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website. And also a big thank you to our transcription team, Sarah Mueller, Anna Dindorf, Britta Bliss, and Stephanie McConnell. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $1 a month. And we also have reward levels on the Patreon page that include access to the behind-the-scenes videos of the taping of our Friday follow-up episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. But the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation in the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can follow along on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on the case. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.